Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm visiting with Professor Andy Clark of the University of Sussex. He's a professor of cognitive philosophy. What is that? The book is The Experience Machine, How Our Minds Predict and Shape Reality. I think, therefore, I am. We learn that in grade school almost, but certainly in college. And what Andy's work and the work of his colleagues have done these last years, this is the frontier of thinking about integration, causal loop for our thoughts, our bodies, our environment, our tools. All of this comes together. There is a poetic way that Annis Nin puts it, once upon a time. We do not see things as they are. We see things as we are. Professor, it's poetic, but at the same time, it was very convincing to me when I came across it, your part of the book. Our whole biome participates in our perception, which we can qualify as this wonderful word, qualia. We can also qualify it as emotions. So, and emotions as markers. I hope I've learned correctly, yeah. Professor. So what is it that Annis Nin is telling us? How is it that our bodies participate in our perception of the world?
Yeah, so I think the lesson that I would take from that is that the predictions that seem to structure the way we experience the world are not just predictions of what's out there, like the white deer that you mentioned earlier, but predictions of what's going on inside our own body, what the sort of current energy needs of our body are, what's the state of our heart rate, what's the state of galvanic skin response right now. So we're busy predicting the external world, but that prediction is constantly overlaid by these, or underlaid, I guess, by these predictions of the internal world. And I think that means that changing the internal predictions can change what we seem to see and perceive. So there are experiments that show that if you give someone false cardiac feedback, you make them think that their heart is beating faster than it really is, maybe by a little wrist-mounted device or something, then under those circumstances, they will perceive a face that would otherwise look neutral as if it was slightly angry, as if they're sort of taking their bodily response and doing a little inference unconsciously, that is something like, well, if my heart's beating a little bit faster, maybe this face is interesting in some way, you know, dangerous or possibly attractive. But that's getting chucked into the pot and making a difference to how we experience the world. So I think that's one of the things that Annis Nin may have meant there, but also that our whole past history comes along with us when we encounter the world, and that what seems to be a simple perception is a reflection of the stuff we've done in the past, as much as it's a reflection of what's out there in the world.
Yes, the word sentience. We come to your part of your book that you call an interlude, and I thought, where are we going now? And I realized that sentience has been used for several hundred years now. I believe that it's 19th century, but Jeremy Bentham, it might be older than that, to assert the supremacy of Homo sapiens. One of the things your book did for me, Professor, is it removed my sense that I know more than Saylor does, or that my brain has more worth than Saylor's. And was that your intention, to make it very clear to us that all animals have sentience?
Yes, that was the intention. The sort of the core thing, the thing that really we should care most about, seems to be shared very, very widely, certainly with lots of other animals. Questions can be raised about, you know, single-celled organisms, and you can go all the way down to plants and raise questions I don't want to address today, because that really is getting into the weeds. But yes, for the other animals, you know, Saylor is a great example. They have all of the core capacities that I think make us objects of moral value. That's to say, you know, they bring predictions to bear on their experiences. They experience the world in the light of their own histories. They don't perhaps, you know, I imagine that Sailor doesn't look as far into the future as you look, for example. And that may make a difference. Also, we human creatures possess this ridiculous thing called language that does seem to do remarkable things to what we can think about and how we perceive ourselves. But I think that's kind of all icing on the cake. The core stuff, sentience, is really widely shared, and it's all about bringing inward-looking prediction together with outward-looking prediction and generating experience.
And emotions. I believe I read that you can't see emotions in when you track brains with the, some of the tools we have, but you use the metaphor of emotions as markers. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's very interesting that, you know, the search for emotional brain circuits versus other brain circuits seems to yield very little. You know, there are you might find some areas that tend to be a bit more involved in certain emotions or certain cognitions, but overall, the effect to me seems to be that that distinction is very dubious, the whole emotion-cognition distinction. And that what emotions maybe are really are underneath all of that is they're reflections of the bodily elements of the prediction machine in action. So I think our emotions, as you know, as William James and others have suggested, are very much tied up with bodily expectations and bodily information. And I think they're doing something else as well. They are cluing us in to how well we're doing at minimizing prediction error. So predictive brains are strongly inclined to try to drive down errors in prediction. And some bits of the world provide us with opportunities to drive down more than expected amounts of prediction error. And they seem to be the bits of the world we like. Other bits can be very boring, where you're not getting rid of more error than expected, or too challenging when you can't get rid of any error at all. So there's a little sweet spot somewhere where we're doing a better than expected at getting rid of error. And I think that's an affectively positive sweet spot. That's part of what emotion is. We're in a good bit of the landscape for learning, really.
Blue Hill, Maine, 2011, Hurricane Irene. You conduct an experiment spontaneously about the taste of honey. What do you learn, Professor?
Yeah, so Blue Hill, Maine, then was, I was kind of stranded there with the philosopher Daniel Dennett. And Dennett is rather famous for his work on consciousness. He wrote a book in 1991 called Consciousness Explained, you know, and has been working on that story ever since. Part of the idea there is that the things that many philosophers find hugely puzzling about consciousness, why it feels the way it does to experience the taste of honey, or why red things look exactly the way they do rather than some other way. Dan's idea was that we're kind of getting the cart before the horse here, that in some sense what's going on is that when we experience the pleasant taste of honey, it's because we expect to have certain kinds of reactions when we encounter honey. We've learned that we tend to lick it. We tend to seek it out. Some individuals have learned the other stuff, but, you know, they've learned that they tend to spit it out, that they don't move towards it. But because we don't really know what's going on inside ourselves as all that's going on, we've got this minimal model of ourselves that then says, well, you know, I'm moving towards the honey because it tastes nice, or because I'm the kind of person that likes honey. But actually, if Dennett is right, the sort of the arrow of influence is going in the other direction. We're observing our own responses, and we're constructing a kind of story around those responses that posits all these things that philosophers have found problematic or difficult. So it's a strong and challenging story. It sort of, it says consciousness is real, but it's not quite what we thought it was. I do think it fits in well with the predictive brain kind of account, although it's in some ways it's a kind of optional extra. That's why in the book I keep it to the level of the interlude.
The predictive brain is always seeking more information. That's why we move. That's why we look around us for other validations of what we're seeing. And the predictive brain seems hungry for better and better data to minimize the error. And that is true for human beings, or the question here is, are there people who do not find that level of curiosity comfortable? Or is that the nature of who we are as Homo sapiens? We're always going to want more information.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It seems to me that there are big individual differences here. So, you know, some people are more exploratory in a given situation than other people. They're more likely to go and forage for new information rather than exploiting the stuff they already know. You know, maybe some people are more inclined to look for a restaurant they haven't been to before rather than to just revisit one that they know does good food. I do think that it's useful in a population to have this sort of spread of tendencies to exploit and tendencies to explore, because, you know, when circumstances change, that could be very, very handy. There have been some members of the population that have been going out and finding new things. And in other times, there'll be others who are making the most of the things that are already there. So I think you do expect individual differences. What's important to me here really is that the predictive brain loves in general to reduce its own uncertainty by taking action. That could be recalling something from your own memory. So you might reduce uncertainty about, you know, what restaurant you want to go to by recalling an experience of having a lovely meal somewhere. You might also try to reduce uncertainty by firing up the web and looking at reviews of restaurants that you've not been to yet. In many ways, the predictive brain doesn't seem to care whether it reduces salient uncertainty by taking internal action or external action. And for me, that's why it's sort of this account fits rather neatly with other stuff that I've been very interested in that we've called the extended mind, that we are, as you say, augmented and extended by our best tools and technologies, the web, etc.
Yes,
and indeed Sailor.
We're going to look to the future when we come back. The extended mind, permission to use everything in your environment. Plus, the book is The Experience Machine, How Our Minds Predict and Shape Reality. Professor Andy Clark of Cognitive Philosophy at the University of Sussex, which Andy tells me is beautifully on the seashore, south of London. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.